The first question is, with the widespread collapse in near all of our institutions and denominations, should you focus on trying to reform them, leave and restart, or seek some other course?
By and large, I agree with the premise of the question that a lot, like I can speak best about the Southern Baptist Convention. I think it is in a very, very advanced state of apostasy. They're meeting this coming week. There'll be some very important issues that'll be described and discussed. But I think it's time. And by the way, a lot of the good churches are already leaving. The real conservative churches are already leaving. And this is going to make it more difficult to even reform the Southern Baptist Convention. It's very hard to get control of it. So I would say I think it's time that new things form. But remember, even those new things can go down very quickly. So remember, at the end of the day, the Lord established His church, not His SBC institution or any other denomination. And so we need to concentrate on the local church level in particular and make sure we keep the local church as solid as can be. But the answer is, I think it's time that new things get formed. But again, not trust in those new forms. And like Calvin would say, we must continually be reforming. And that is ourselves, our churches, and our denominations.
Next question is, at what point might it be appropriate for a region, state, or people to break away from the union? And how could support be garnered from people of that region to break away? Do either of you want this, or is this mine?
Yeah,
it's probably mine. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so the classic response to this, at least before the Civil War, was when there's a violation of the Constitution that can't be rectified. And that's the point at which the union is abrogated. The Constitution is null and void. And at that point, you have you don't have to, but you at least have the right to break away from the union. So now you have to ask the question, at least based on that, is the Constitution null and void? Is it is the way we're operating, is it unconstitutional? Is it unfair to certain regions and states? And if a state or a region feel that, you know, they're not getting a fair deal, because that's the point of the republic, the federal republic we live in, it's for mutual benefit for all the parties, then I would say, yeah, they do have that right. But I can, I guess, explain that more, but I with short answer, I don't want to go into a lot of detail just because I could get into the weeds pretty easily on this. But whether they have the right and whether it's practical are two different questions. So let's say you agree with me and you say, well, yeah, they can do that. Like, you know, national divorce is possible. And, you know, there's even situations you'll say maybe where divorce itself is permissible when the wedding vows are abrogated and that kind of thing. But doing it, like, what's going to happen, right? Didn't the last time this was tried, wasn't there a war? And do you really want a war? I don't think you have to have a war, but the reality is there's going to be a lot of pushback. So currently, in California, there is an effort in Northern California to start a new state called Jefferson, which is more conservative. You have the eastern sides of both Washington and Oregon wanting to separate from their coastal areas and join Idaho. You have, there's a secession movement in Alaska. There's a secession movement in Hawaii. Texas usually gets makes the headlines for this, but I would say there's not probably a lot of hope for Texas doing this, the more purple they become. So there are people that want this kind of thing. In New York, you even hear it once in a while where I am. The upstaters don't want to be governed by the city anymore, and they would like to govern themselves. And all of it is for peace. All of it is so people who are alike and called monocultural can live together without having the strife with dealing with another culture that shares totally different values than or believes totally different things in them. So yeah, I guess that's not really a specific answer of like, yes, do it. It's more of a prudence. Like, You have to weigh the options and the benefits and see if the people actually have the will, because it's going to be, there's going to be sacrifices. There's going to be strife in the process. And are they willing to sacrifice financially or otherwise to stare down the national or the general government? That's the hard part. You saw what happened with Roy Moore years ago, right, in Alabama with the Ten Commandments display. I mean, it was federal laws that supposedly he was violating. And it seems to me that the people who use more, and this isn't necessarily secession, but just assert their right as a state to nullify unconstitutional laws, to go their own way, they tend to be on the left. It's like marijuana laws, right? It's things like that that end up being the ways today that people or states assert their authority. And so I think conservatives need to look at this a little more. It is a tool in our arsenal that we haven't really thought about, and we just need to be creative about how and when it's used. And so, yeah, I don't have any specifics on it, but hopefully that helps. So, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, two things. One, I think we should think more about the right to revolt or right to revolution, especially along Christian lines. I mean, if as Americans we should generally think there is a right to revolution. I think there's a lot of problems, not theoretically, but practically, mainly because of who controls cities. Cities are usually the hubs of transportation, logistics. So even if the most conservative state will secede or, you know, revolts, who's going to control the city? It's going to be the left, and so it's not, probably not going to work. But I think along those lines, though, which I think is kind of the general idea of the question, I think we should reemphasize the importance of the federal system, the federalist system, meaning the states still retain a certain degree of sovereignty. And also we should think of the states and the power of the states as not a derived power. So it's not as if you have the federal government, it gets its power from God, and therefore it kind of flows from there to the states. We should think of as the federal government has its power and the state governments have their powers. And those are derived from God, each. So that means Texas and Wisconsin, each has from their power, they have that from God. Which means that the governor of states and the state legislatures they're not bound to follow whatever the federal government tells them to do. They have their own power. They have to look to the good of their own states. They're not a delegated authority. They're elected and they have the power from the people. And so I think that we should look to the states and encourage the states to use their power to resist and to shape their state to what is good, and to resist what is evil coming from the federal government. So instead of revolution, we can actually use this very system that we were given to have a legitimate resistance, using a legitimate power against the illegitimate use of power from the federal government.
The next one's for you, too. Stephen mentioned the idea that we would do well to be less anti-authoritarian, per se, that when civil leaders execute their authority within the bounds of natural moral laws, we should follow. How can we guard ourselves from error on both sides, being passive followers for speaking out when it may be necessary? Does it make sense? How can we guard ourselves from the error on both sides, being passive followers for speaking out when it may be necessary?
I think I understand. If I don't understand, I apologize. Did I say that we should be less anti-authoritarian? I hope I didn't say exactly that. It has quotes as if I said that. So I guess this gives me a chance to. I don't want to be authoritarian. I do think, though, that again, the states should use their authority in ways that seek not just neutrality or some kind of negative liberty. That is just letting people do what they want to do. But also have a positive vision of what the good is and use that power to direct people in that. So there is a balance. There's on one side, there's license, which is to just let people do whatever degenerate thing they do and think, you know, fantastically that that's not going to affect people around them. And then there's the other side, which is essentially being a nanny state and being kind of a school monitor and observing everything you do. So there is a balance there, and this is the art of politics and on the practical side. And I'll just say I'm a philosopher, not a not a politician. And so I don't know where that balance is in each actually specific location. This would be in counties and states and even the federal level. So yeah, there certainly is that balance. But my main point was simply that instead of neutrality, instead of negative liberty, we ought to say, look, we have this God-given power. That is, the civil leaders have this power. It's for our good. It's to suppress evil. And so we ought to assert that positive vision, that positive good, for without stepping into too much kind of nanny-ish type government. So hopefully that answered the question.
A lot of these are political, by the way. So if you want to jump in, thoughts on the Benedict option and localism as countermeasures to national dissolution.
So Benedict option means whatever you want it to mean. So I don't want to really comment on that. But the localism versus nationalism thing, I do want to talk about that. So I'm all for both, and I think there has to be both. So I was just in Nebraska at a friend's church in Nebraska near Scottsbluff. And he was telling me that for generations, it was a German kind of weird German-Russian ethnic thing in Scottsbluff area. And he was telling me all about that. And he said within the last 10 years, there have been a steady, but strong stream of Hispanic immigrants coming into that community. And they've tried their best to be hospitable and nice, but it's still overwhelmed, and it's changing the characteristics of that local community. I even, when I drove by, I saw a flag that was half Mexican, half American flag, which is really weird. But the point is, this community didn't vote to have this sort of demographic change happen within a decade, but it happened because of national policy. So you can act locally all day long, but the national policy is going to affect local places. So you can't really expect, you can't put all of your, our daily lives, practically, it's going to be spent in our local, you know, place. But I think there still has to be a national policy, because that protects the local places. So we can't just act locally to the exclusion of the nation.
Yeah. Trying to find one that would be more up here. Here. Oh, here's one. Is the attack on progressivism now eclipsing the attack of atheism upon the church? Should the effort of apologetics alter its focus? So that's more of a theological question, if you understand it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You got it.
I think so. Let me hold on to that, though. Okay. Of course, progressivism is, we usually use the term liberalism, and it usually does have, today, at least an atheistic bent to it, of course. But, yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, a few years ago, I think it was Sam Harris and a few others like this, they were very popular, this new atheism. That's sort of faded now. But it's always progressivism in society, within the church. And by progressivism, I'm especially, they want to sort of change the gospel. And usually they want to change the gospel so it'll be more acceptable to the world. And that's usually a disaster. But yes, overall, I would say that progressivism, as opposed to just straight out atheism, okay? It's usually atheism, in my opinion, to be really effective, it has to kind of come in another garb. If somebody just says they deny God or whatever, it's usually not too good of a, it's not well accepted. But if you turn it into something like deism, there's a God, but God just doesn't care about what's going on. He's got other things to do. That actually is much more a difficult form of atheism to go after. So progressivism usually takes atheism and puts it in a more difficult garb in order to go after, in my opinion. Should the efforts of apologetics alter its focus. Yes, we've got to constantly change some of our apologetics. Now, not the fundamentals of it, but we need to change our approaches sometimes, the way we discuss certain issues, based on what the new issues are. So when something comes up like postmodernism, well, we haven't had anything quite like it. I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. So I'm not saying it's totally brand new, but at the same time, our arguments against it are going to have to change with the new threat. Let's put it that way, okay?
Another one for you. I think a lot of these are for you. Stephen points out that Baptists need to join the fray. Oh, this is for me? Okay. You're a fast reader. Join the fray. You did this one?
No.
I should have made a rule. If you're on the panel, you don't write a... Stephen points out that Baptists need to join the fray and construct a Baptist positive vision for the nation. What do the two Baptists think about? You're right, it is for us. How does it differ from a Presbyterian version? I don't think it actually differs that much, because what you're talking about is mostly, I would say, was accepted by and large with a broad Protestantism at the foundation of the country. So we had different Protestant groups in different areas, and they were able to get along and form a civil society together where you could have differences, where Massachusetts was Puritan and Virginia was more Anglican or Episcopalian later. And that was perfectly fine. They could still they could still join together for common defense and for trade and those kinds of things, which is what general welfare means. So I don't think it actually differs a whole lot. I mean, I don't know. You talk about baptism a little bit, I guess, as like a possible entryway into civil society or something like that. And I think we would probably say no. But I'm trying to think. I mean, you haven't read Stephen's book?
But I listening to his lecture today about positive vision, correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, but it's not that we just, let's say, try to counter the evil in our society or just curb evil in society, but also push for righteous laws, more of a positive vision. Instead of just playing defense, as it were, let's be more on the offensive, where we're trying to really craft laws that would reflect righteousness as opposed to just trying to curb the wickedness out there. And in that, absolutely. I thought that was, if I'm understanding you right, absolutely. I'm right there with you on that.
I think it brings up an important point, and you may all know this, but in the book I call it Pan-Protestantism, and it's like a principle diversity among different denominations, kind of living together and acknowledging each other's faith. So one of the benefits of being a Protestant is that you being a Christian is a matter of true faith, which is fundamentally, principally, an inward thing. You have trust, you have faith in Christ and His work, and so it's not a matter so much of which church institution you're a part of. So it's not like Roman Catholicism where you're kind of in or you're out. I mean, I know there's some whatever they think, whatever they believe now. But within Protestantism, there is, it's not this idea that if you're in the right institution, that means you're in. So Protestants can actually affirm each other's mutual faith. You can say that this Baptist church is, I can, you know, say this is a true church with a legitimate, perhaps not entirely properly administered, and I would call them sacraments, and you guys maybe ordinances, whatever. But we would still acknowledge their legitimacy, their effectiveness, or whatever, and also that the word is preached. Though right next door there'd be a Presbyterian, my Presbyterian church, and we would, hopefully the Baptists would reciprocate the acknowledgement of truth. Anyway, we won't go into that. But anyway, you can have this order where we're Protestants, we affirm each other's mutual faith, and it's not based on compromise, it's not pragmatism, it's just the principle of the common theology that we can do that. Because we affirm the same gospel, we can then get along well and be on the same stage. So...
this is another one I think for you. Did the Immigration Act of 1965 make the present disunity inevitable? And then the question is it irreversible? That's a landmine here.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think that law was absolutely disastrous. It was promised that it wouldn't bring in as many immigrants as it did. I have an article coming out on Monday, and it's about national hospitality for immigrants and kind of the limits of it, but also the duty of it. And so I'm certainly in favor of a nation being hospitable to people who are different than them. But there also has to be managed such that that nation maintains itself. Like a nation's not obligated, just like a family is not obligated to be so hospitable that it destroys the family or, you know, they go under in some sense. The same thing with the nation is not required to essentially harm itself in the reception of immigrants. But that act just opened up the floodgates for that precisely to happen. And certainly contributed to this would be the inability to secure the southern border as well. Is it irreversible? I do think that over time, people can come together when they have common experiences, when there's intermarriage, and there's common struggles. So you think of how World War II tended to unite, you know, like, I guess, old stock Anglos and Italians and all those who fought then. Theodore Roosevelt's talking about this, about the Civil War. The Civil War is, ironically, he was arguing that it was a means of unity. This is after immigration, and I think, well, we talked about that last night. But so there are like great events in history that can actually unite a people. I don't know what that event might be, but I do think if we continue the kind of mass immigration there, I don't know how we would reverse whatever that means. I don't know. But
here's another landmine question. This is all the juicy ones here. How should Christians think of Southern gentlemen theologians who attempted to biblically justify Southern slavery? I think this is for you, right? No. if you want to add in, I'll just give it a shot. So, I think there's a lot of distinctions that have to be made in thinking through this. But the first one is whether it's slavery in the abstract or slavery in the concrete. In other words, is someone giving a defense? We're obviously talking, you know, when it was a practice in this country. At that time, were there theologians giving a defense for slavery perpetually throughout time? Like, that's God's, you know, pattern, and that's what we should have. That's a lot different than someone saying, we have a present circumstance which is very challenging, and there's really no easy way to form a plan of emancipation. One of the things the Southerners required for emancipation, though those who owned slaves, was they needed compensation, and then needed to be integration into broader American society. And without those two things, if you just emancipated slaves, it would be to their detriment, and would also be to the detriment of the Southern economy. So it was one of these things. I think Jefferson said, we have the bull by the ears. There's not an easy way to deal with this. And it formed organically. There was no governing body that came and voted on it. It just kind of happened. So in all my study of this, you know, Palmer and Dabney and Thornwell and all these Southern theologians, and by the way, a lot of Northern Puritan theologians waited on this too. I mean, Jonathan Edwards now gets a bad rap for this too, because he supposedly justified slavery. If you look at a lot of the things that they're saying, they're talking about present circumstances, and they're looking at the Bible, and they're trying to say what's the highest moral good that we can do under present circumstances, not ideal circumstances. We don't have those. We have to live in the real world. And so, unfortunately, I think the sad tragedy of the Civil War and Reconstruction is that you had, and the estimates are now, about 1 million slaves died during that whole ordeal, 1 million, and starved after the war, you know, decimated the economy. And so you have freedom, but in the worst possible conditions imaginable. And it's partially, I think, what's contributed to the situation we have today with poverty in some of the descendants of those communities, where there's a dependency on government programs and things like that. And the last thing I'll say is this, because I think they're not exactly the same, but welfare is not biblical, right? If a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. Our welfare system's not biblical. Would I say overnight that we should get rid of the welfare system? No. that would be really bad if overnight we have to figure out a way to progressively somehow get rid of this. And I wouldn't call someone who's a welfare worker, who's a Christian, who's helping feed people in sin, even though they're in this unjust system of some kind. This system that we'll say isn't ideal and needs to be done away with in a wise way. So that's I think one. There's several modern parallels I see that in some respects. That's one of them where it's unbiblical. It's not ideal, but it's one of these things that like. I'm not like a welfare defender because I just said what I said. I'm not like an apologist for welfare because I think that for the present circumstance, you know, we need it and we can't just get rid of it overnight. So hopefully that makes sense. I think we can view men who thought differently than us, than we do today about these issues, with a lot of charity, grace, not using presentism. We can look at the circumstances they were in. And then our main duty is just to compare it to the Bible. What does the Bible say about these things? What does loving your neighbor mean in these circumstances? And, it was regulated in the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, Paul gives instructions to slaves and slave masters. So they're reading the same Bible, the people who are thinking through that. So now there's probably a million other questions about it. Did you want to say anything? Did I? Okay. It's not like I get this question sometimes. So, is the USA headed to city states or something else? I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Classical city states?
I mean, cities seem to be governing the states. You know, like, and Atlanta governs all of Georgia now, so.
Oh, is that what that's saying?
I'm guessing.
I was thinking classical city states, like Athens.
It seems that way, though, right? Yeah, it seems like it's heading towards the.
The cities in America, many of them are getting larger, and with that, the city, like again, take a Chicago. I mean, they control Illinois, but you get outside of Chicago, it's a different. It's like Wisconsin, or even here in Wisconsin, you have two cities probably that control most of the politics of here. And so as cities get larger, their influence gets a lot larger, and it can be difficult. It can be difficult. And they can turn into sort of a city state because they're controlling the land all around. So in that sense, it's like the city becomes the state because they – so yes, in some ways, I think that's happening.
That's erased. Okay, could the government colluding with corporations possibly be a greater threat than the government itself to Christian values and culture? It seems that those large businesses are a huge aspect of shifting morality in America through media marketing, messages, etc. Okay, and here's the second part. Would cultivating Christian culture through supporting small businesses that align better with our values rather than the large ones and connecting to the community undermine their power and affect godly change? Are there other solutions to industry and government collusion? That's a good question. Yes, I'm for it. That's really all I have to say. Like, I tell my wife, let me be practical here. I try not to shop at Amazon, right? If I can't find it anywhere else, I guess, I'm going to Amazon. And, I don't know if that makes me pro-slavery. I mean, the sweatshop labor that Amazon, puts out there, and if you see some of what these corporations are doing, they like Google to make your iPhone. There's laborers in Africa working in these mines and stuff. And anyway, I'm still thinking of that previous question, but it's a hard thing. And here, I don't think you're in sin for doing it. I don't think you're in sin for purchasing from Amazon or from Google in and of itself. The sin, what they do is on them, right? But at the same time, if there's another available option for you for a local, righteous person, a fellow Christian that you can support their business and get the same need met, man, I'd rather do that. And I've told my wife, please, let's not go into Hannaford, which is our local shopping market. They got rainbow flags everywhere right now. And let's go to, as long as we have the option, let's go to ShopRite. They don't have that. Now those options are disappearing because now, everyone's getting in on it, but we do try to think local and act local as much as possible. So, yeah, I canceled my Prime. So, And she does not go to Target under any circumstance. That is a sin, by the way. No. So I will say that. No. So. All right. Can you expand on natural law? How is this different from divine law? Was not are different with the... I'm not sure what that means. The difference with the king of England over the rule of law. Did we or do we not believe all are to be under the law? Which law? Are civil magistrates supposed to make law or codify for new situations?
Here, give me that. Go one at a time here. Yeah, so natural law, natural law is the universal law that is, we could also call it the moral law. It's all of us are under that universally, so whether you're Christian or not Christian, under that law, it's essentially covers the entirety of righteousness, and it's summarized in the Ten Commandments. So that would be the natural law. You can think of divine law as any law that's given by God in a supernatural sense that is given, typically just think as scripture, or if God told you right now to do something, that would be a kind of divine law. But that law is either consistent with the natural law, or it's just a sort of restatement of it. So honor your father and mother in scripture is essentially an inscripturated natural command that all human beings are required to affirm and to obey. And so you can have, really scriptural law, when God tells you to do something in scripture, apart from things that are unique to the gospel, those moral commands are simply restatements of what you should have known if you thought properly in your brain. if your mind was sound, you would know that would be true, and you'd have the will and desire and affection to follow that that law. So that's what I affirm. I think that's a traditional Reformed view. It's a traditional everyone view until fairly recently, I think. I think maybe the Anabaptists rejected it back in the day. I don't know what that one. So what does a civil magistrate do with that law? I'd say that in a way they can create law, but only if it's derived from the natural law or the moral law or the inscripturated law that's in scripture. So that's the magistrate's job, is to look at the circumstances on the ground, see maybe perhaps a problem that's occurring in society, and saying we need a law that directs people properly to avoid whatever evil or harm that's occurring in that particular society. And perhaps if it extinguishes the harm or directs them to what is good. So in a sense, they create law, but it's also derived. So it's both. I would say it's both theonomic in the sense that it's ultimately rooted in God's moral law, but it's also, we might say, autonomic, meaning that it actually comes from the will and the deliberation of the civil ruler, but of course derived. So. Hopefully, does that meet? I know who asked it back there. So hopefully that meets your satisfaction.
Okay. I like this question. This is for Dr. Fuller. Was Pharisee legalism a direct product of the Babylonian exile? Was the origin of the term Jewish? I think asking, is that where the term Jewish came from?
The Pharisees were not a direct product. And it says Pharisee legalism, a direct product of the Babylonian exile. No, I don't think so. Now, things after the Babylonian exile, you see the synagogue for the first time, as opposed, because the temple was the place of the main place of worship. But being in Babylon and so forth, they started developing the synagogues. The Pharisees really didn't come into effect until around 180, 170 BC. The exile, you're looking at, I'm just putting general numbers out here, let's say 530 BC. So it's quite a few years later. The Pharisees, that word has the idea of separateness. And what it was is they were sort of a reaction to the Syrians who are trying to force the Jews to become more humanistic, like the Greeks. And they resisted that. And the Pharisees were like a separated group. They wanted to stick to Judaism, the revealed religion, and not go over toward humanism as they were being forced. At first, Pharisaism was, I think, a very, I mean, if we lived in that day, I think they would be the Orthodox party. And I think we would, those would be the folks that we would go with. But any group over time can become legalistic. The word Pharisee doesn't mean legalistic, okay? And they didn't form themselves to be, quote-unquote, legalistic. But again, any group can become that way. But at first, when they come on the scene, I think we would be much more positive toward them. But by the time of the New Testament, yes, they are consumed with legalism. They would be more of a works-type salvation. And the Pharisaism of the New Testament does become what is known today as more Orthodox Judaism. Okay?
Good, good. You know, I thought I'd get more questions about beauty and sublimity, but there aren't any. it's not the hot topic right now. So I guess we only have like three more of these cards. So I'll read all three of them. This is the next one. Any luck with G3? That's the question. End quote. So I'll just say this. For those who don't know, I'll just briefly explain. G3 Ministries has put up a number of blogs critical of Christian nationalism, specifically some of the things Stephen Wolfe says in his book. I reached out to three of the top guys, actually some of them separately, and tried to facilitate some kind of a discussion or like inviting them on the podcast to try to maybe find common ground. And I guess maybe they were a little, one of them I think was a little offended. He sent me an email. He wasn't happy that I had made the point that, they had James Lindsay, who's an atheist, on a podcast to explain wokeness, which I'm fine with. That's fine. But I said, if you could find common cause with an atheist, like maybe we could find common cause with Christian nationalists, right? Like we could work together to end abortion or something. There's no movement in that direction. As far as I know now, they've dropped communication with me, and, I don't have anything negative to say about them other than just, it's just sad to me. Like, I would love to see Christians who aren't really that far apart work together more. But I did put out a podcast last week, I think it was. I don't know if some of you might have seen it, where I talk about kind of what I think has been going on for a long time in the Christian industry. And I just made the point that there's a lot of fashion branding. There's a lot of, like, a business model kind of thing going on. And that may explain some of the separations we see that don't, I think, seem to make sense from the pews. When we're thinking, like, we got, like, drag queens trying to groom kids. Like, I don't know, like, some of these littler squabbles don't seem to matter that much. But when you're in an institution and you're, when you have an image to kind of manage and to promote, people who are closer to you can end up looking like threats sometimes or like competition or, it sometimes is harder to work together. As weird as that sounds, even though you're closer and you're brothers in Christ, sometimes those things can be hard. And that's my only way of trying to make sense of it. So I'm going out on a limb to try to explain that to you, to at least explain how I'm thinking about it. But I'll put it this way. I said to someone who asked me about it before dinner, I said, look, they may not think that I'm on, like they may not see themselves on my team, but I'm on their team. And I support what they do, which is good and righteous, and I think that's how we have to be. Like, you know, if they're doing the right thing on certain issues, even if I disagree with other things, I'm going to support that. So, if you guys have anything to add, okay. Okay, is there an elephant in the room? Has not social justice replaced a biblical definition of sin with racism, of reconciliation, and racial equity, equality of outcomes?
I'll take that one. The elephant in the room. Okay. Yes, with social justice, it's not the justice that you would see in Scripture. It's more of a group. It's justice for a group as opposed to justice for an individual. And so, yes, when they talk about justice, when I talk about justice, it's two different things many times. I'm talking about what God has declared is just. And it's not just simply to have, as they say here, equality of outcomes. As individuals, we're all different. None of us are going to have the same outcomes, you know. And what we want is a system where the law is evenly applied, that under the law we're equal in that sense. Now, again, there's always, you know, like, we don't expect the same from a 12-year-old as we do an adult. Okay. But at the same time, we want the law to be, in general, equal for all. We don't want the law to favor one person or one group over the other. And so we're not looking, again, for equality of outcome. Okay? That's, I think, well, you know, well said here. And yes, social justice is really oftentimes injustice, okay, in my opinion. When you see what comes out, you see a lot of injustice, what we would call social justice. And so that's pretty much it.
This is like a three-parter, so I'll give the mic right back to you. Dr. Fuller, what resources would you recommend to someone who is learning how to study and interpret the Bible? You know, you have an article coming out on TruthScript this week, I think, on this.
So. Okay, yes, I do. Yeah. I do. On TruthScript, which is a website that John's putting together, is I come up with like 10, and I think I make it 11, though, resources that have been very helpful to me in the theological realm. So things like Machen's book on Christianity and Liberalism. It was a book written back around 1925, somewhere in that area, 23. And really, the issues he was going up against back then are really this, pretty much the same issues that are going on today. They've changed appearance a little bit, but it's almost like that book was written, you know, yesterday. And so that's a very fine book. The book I mentioned earlier tonight, and you can get this free on the internet, A Way to Pray by Matthew Henry, is fantastic. It's what he does is he groups scriptures into certain, let's say, prayer topics. And as you pray through that, you're praying with scriptural language. And a lot of times, you're just praying the scriptures. And then he has special chapters, you know, like family prayers, prayers before you go on a trip, you know, all kinds of things. It's really neat. And I find that very helpful. There's another book I like called Valley of Vision. It's put out by Banner Truth, and it's a collection of Puritan prayers. And again, I like that very much, and so I highly suggest that. I like Pilgrim's Progress. I think Pilgrim's Progress is a great commentary of the Christian life and the growth in the Christian life. And again, it's something that's helped Christians for centuries. And so again, I highly recommend a book like that. Use it all the time. I'm obviously a big fan of the Puritans. I like, there's a two-volume set that I use for like a daily devotion. And the name of it is not coming to my mind right now. It's put out by Banner Truth. And it's, again, it's just one-page devotionals. And it'll come to me about halfway back to Louisville, I bet. But I can almost see it, but I can't. It's put out by Banner Truth, I can tell you that. And it's good because it gives you, if you haven't read much of the Puritans, it'll give you a good introduction to sort of their literature and their faith and so forth. Very helpful. Very helpful. I already mentioned the commentary of Matthew Henry as well. I find that, again, extremely helpful. There's a book on inspiration by Edward Young, Thy Word is Truth. That doctrine's always important. And so I really like E.J. Young, Thy Word is Truth. I highly recommend that work. Let me think. What was any of the other ones on there? It's not coming to me. But a lot of times I like to, again, to read the old Puritans. I find them, oh, J.C. Ryle. Anything that man wrote, read it. You'll be benefited by it. His classic is probably Holiness. But he did a lot of stuff, and I really like J.C. Ryle. And so basically anything you can find out there of his is worth reading. It is worth reading. So I very much like that as well. And I guess that's... And let me say this. Read the Bible. A lot of times we read books about the Bible. Read the Bible. Read the primary source. That's what you really is very helpful, okay? And so read the Word of God. And again, with someone like Matthew Henry, you'll be blessed. And it will really help you in that way. And so that those would be some of the books I read.
Okay, second to last question here. John, how would you respond to people who use their experience in nature to point towards false deities? I just want to say thank you, whoever referenced my speech. I appreciate that. Thank you. So I did try to kind of address this, but it was pretty quick. And so there are, I think I mentioned transcendentalists, environmentalists, pagan societies, that they all get this wrong in different ways. They like nature, right? I mean, you can probably go to like your local, I don't know if they have, do you have Sierra Club here? I don't know if that's a thing. Yeah? Okay. They do. Okay. Someone's telling me they do. So you go to your local Sierra Club chapter or something and you're going to find some real, you know, granola crunchers there. That's what my wife and I call them. Like they're into nature, but, they're obviously, not Christians. They're not, they worship nature. And that's the primary problem. And I think Romans 1 addresses that pretty clearly, that we shouldn't have any excuse because we can see that we have a creator, we have a conscience, we know certain attributes of God, but yet we suppress the truth and unrighteousness, and we worship the creator, or the creature rather than the creator. And that's the main problem. So like going back into nature isn't like that doesn't solve all your issues. And by the way, I was trying to speak to Christians. I was saying, if you're a Christian, you need to be out in God's creation more. Like, as in general, the stats show that as people, we need that more. But yeah, if you're a pagan and you're going out into nature, that's not going to convert you, obviously. That's not going to, the gospel's not going to be found there. You're going to gain a conviction if you're thinking rightly about it. You're going to see that there's a someone who designed the place. But the problem, you know, with the those who worship false deities is they suppress that truth. So that's an internal thing they're doing. It's not the creation's fault, right? It's them. They want to take a certain aspect of creation and treat it like it's the creator. And I think at the end of the day, it's because they don't want to be accountable. That's most people, right? They don't want to be accountable for their sin. They're more comfortable with a God that looks like them in their image, whatever. So yeah, I mean, look, people can read the Bible too. I mean, Dr. Fuller just came from a seminary full of people who knew the Bible real well, right? But where a converted heart makes a difference when you're looking at these things. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that question was for me.
But, I know. The two-volume set, it's called Voices from the Past. Okay, Voices from the Past. Okay. Again, a lot of folks will know all about what scholars say about the Bible, but they don't read the Bible. So, read the Bible.
All right. And the last one's for Stephen. Many people have accused you of being against interracial marriage and of advocating violence. How do you respond?
Okay. All right. So, I have never said anything negative about interracial marriage. And in fact, in the book itself, I say that intermarriage is key to bringing different peoples together and to make them one people. People are abusing what I've said, which was that it's generally good for people of similar culture to marry as a group, because that's a way to perpetuate that culture. So if everyone is different, everyone married someone different, that would disrupt the transmission of culture. And so it's generally good in terms of culture, cultural groups, which can include people of different genetics and ancestry. That is different, people of different ancestry can share the same culture. Those people generally should marry, or in order to perpetuate culture, but that doesn't preclude any kind of interethnic marriage. They've basically taken that and that sort of thing and then gone into, you know, you're against interracial marriage. So that's false, but my interest was just, okay, you have a culture, it's been transmitted to you as a people. How is that best kept alive and flourish? How do you honor those who delivered the good things of your culture to you? And generally speaking, as a group, that would be marrying those who share that culture, so then you can transmit that to your children. But again, does not preclude marrying people outside the culture at the individual level. So anyway, that's what I was trying to get at. In terms of the violence, I wrote an argument that justified violent revolution, which was the American Revolution was a violent revolution. But I'm not advocating for violence for individuals or now. So, no. Yeah, it was a theoretical argument, and so I'm not saying, you know, go pick up your guns and pitchforks and let's do some militia drills outside. I'm not saying let's do that. But like I said earlier, though, I think we have to think more about, as Christians, the right to revolution. Though I don't think at this moment that would be appropriate or good or feasible or just or achieve any kind of end that we'd want.
I think that's the last question. So, man, I appreciate everyone who came out and hung with us till the end of the conference, and we'll be around, I guess, for however long the building.